We know that the cross marks the death of Jesus. In order to be his disciple, you have to value all that you hold dear a little less. Or you have to turn away some on account of the fact that to truly follow his ways, you will take on great suffering. You may even be called to lay down your life for the sake of another.
That's the Reverend Dr. Jared Longbons, and today he shares an inspiring message of faith called Jesus, Not a Good Pitchman. I'm Peter Wallace. It's day one.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're delighted to welcome the Reverend Dr. Jared Longbons, Senior Minister of Peachtree Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in Atlanta, Georgia. Jared is a graduate of Lincoln Christian University, having earned his bachelor's degree and a master's in contemporary theology there. He earned his PhD in theology from the University of Nottingham. In addition to serving the local church in his theological scholarship, he enjoys the occasional adjunct teaching position and opportunities to speak and lecture. Jared, welcome to Day One.
Thank you for having me.
You were last with us 2 years ago in the first year of the pandemic, so how have things been going at Peachtree Christian Church since that great disruption? How have you all coped?
Well, I think that we've tried our very, very best to stay in community, even though we were apart.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're coming back together and finding that solace in each other's company. But at the very same time, like most churches, we still see a lot of people viewing us online, participating mm-hmm. online, and we're just trying to figure out what the new next phase is.
Mm-hmm. And part of that next phase is a new program and planning. Tell us about that.
Well, we're going to work on a respite care for people who happen to have dementia,
mm-hmm.
A program that will work probably 2 days a week to start for loved ones of people who take care of their loved ones who have dementia or Alzheimer's or other disabilities. And we want to be a place where people can come and seek solace and the refuge of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest. And we know that caregivers really need rest. And so we want to provide that. At the same time, we want to provide for the people who happen to have dementia a place that dignifies them and cares for them as true people, full people, not diminished peoples.
Mm-hmm. You are the sixth senior minister of Peachtree Christian Church, and it's nearing a century of ministry. What are some of the highlights of that ministry over the decades and in more recent times?
Well, I think that we've always had a lovely arts program, and I've highlighted that here before about how we're in the arts district and how we really want to celebrate the arts. We've done so musically for many, many years. Right now, we're taking on a new visual arts piece, so not only just having art shows from time to time, but actually housing a collection of original Chagall lithographs.
Wow.
And we're hopeful that we can help people connect to Christ through the beauty of creative work, as God is the great creator. Another thing that we've been a part of is just helping start ministries like Midtown Assistance Center.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a ministry that we're a part of called Peachtree Christian Health out in Gwinnett County, which is a full-time adult day facility for people who happen to have dementia and other cognitive decline. So we are really working hard to be local in our ministry focus and also have global scope, just like any church would want to do. But we kind of lean into the idea of trying to be a cathedral for the city, a place where people can gather to learn and to be uplifted in their thinking.
Mm-hmm. I understand you preached your first sermon at age 15. Did you know you wanted to become a pastor that early, or how did your calling come about?
Well, when I was 15, I wanted to be an actor.
Ah.
That's all I ever wanted to do, in fact. And I'll never forget the day at Hardee's, a fast food chain, after youth group. My youth minister was talking to a group of boys. I, on the other hand, was flirting with a group of young girls, and he said, "You too, Jared." And I turned my head to him, and I said, "What?" He goes, "If you ever want to learn how to teach a Bible study or preach, just let me know." And I said, Okay, thanks. And he, to his credit, did a great job of actually giving us opportunities to lead and to imagine ministry. And when I turned 17 years old, I was at an event praying, and I just had this notion that maybe that's I was called to preach. And I remember going to him and saying, don't tell my mom, don't tell my dad, but I think I might be called to preach. And he goes, yeah, I know. Then we went to my mom 2 weeks later. Don't tell dad, but I think I might be called to preach. She goes, oh, honey, I know. And so then later on that summer, I'm playing catch with my dad. And I said, Dad, I just wonder, I think maybe I'm supposed to be a minister. And he goes, I've been waiting for you to tell me, son. And then we went to the church elders and the pastor, and they all confirmed it. And boy, oh boy, I don't think I could do anything else. I think it would follow me into whatever other pursuit I would do.
Of course, you are a Christian Church Disciples of Christ minister, but you've served over the years in the three main branches of the Campbellstone Movement: Disciples, Independent Christian Churches, and Churches of Christ. And that's, I understand, fostered a desire in you for interdenominational unity and authentic community. Would you say more about how that desire for unity came about for you and how it plays out in your ministry?
Well, in our tradition, we are a unity movement, trying to seek for the unity of all Christians. So that's already kind of baked into my education and my formation as a seminarian. But when I was a child, I was raised half in this world and then half Catholic with my father. And my dad was always exposing me to Catholic theology and liturgy. And sometimes we would go to churches and we would hear people who spoke against Catholicism. And my dad would say, you misunderstand the point. And so I think even from a very young age, before I even had an inkling of a notion of ministry, there was this desire to say, we need to be on the same team because we already are. And I often say, if there are no atheists in foxholes, there's no denominations either. And as the world gets more secularized, we're going to care much less about the denominational lines. It's going to be the case where we look each other in the eye and say, oh, what, you follow Christ? So do I. Let's get together. So I think it's actually urgent. It's not even just a happy thought. It's an urgency thing for me.
The late, great Fred Craddock is a mentor of yours, the great disciples, pastor and preacher, former teacher of preaching at Candler School of Theology. And I understand you're planning a preaching lectureship in his memory. Tell us about that.
Well, being that we are in the middle of Midtown Atlanta, and the fact that the church up in the mountains where Fred retired no longer has the Fred Craddock Lectureship, I thought, well, what a great opportunity for us to bring it here because we're in a centralized location. He left an indelible imprint of his ministry at our church and our tradition, and one of the gifts of our tradition has been good preaching. And so I think that it would be a wonderful gift to not only the theological world, but the city and its ministers and around the area, to host at least an annual lectureship with a notable preacher or teacher of preachers to come in and help with people who are in the pulpits think about ways to engage the text for the community, but also with an eye towards doing so in an increasingly secular time. So I want to be innovative with it and ask the question of how can we preach more effectively given a multimedia world that is, you know, the proliferation of content is amazing. And then how is it that we can preach perhaps in a way that would affect or be helpful to people who suffer from even mental illness, right? Mental difficulties because of the saturated content that comes into our brains. How can we get people to slow down and hear it? So I'm very interested in those questions, and I'm very excited about launching this in partnership with other organizations.
Well, Jared, your sermon today is based on the gospel lesson for this Sunday from Luke chapter 14. Would you read it for us?
I'd be delighted. Now large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' or what king going out to wage war against another king will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If he cannot, then, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for the terms of peace. So therefore, none of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions.
These are some pretty direct words from Jesus about what it means to follow him. What struck you as you prepared your sermon?
Well, almost always when I read this passage, I think about how much I love my mom and dad. And I love my wife and my kids. And it's been called a hard saying of Jesus. And I think what really strikes me is the way we think about the word hate in our current world versus maybe how this word has been translated. And then, even still, if we soften it and say things like, well, it means consider these things less important than following Jesus, still, Jesus is calling for what Bonhoeffer called a single-minded focus on Christ, which is always a daunting thought.
Jared, your sermon is entitled, Jesus, Not a Good Pitchman. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you. My brother-in-law is a creative guy. In fact, he owns a 3D printer and makes all sorts of novelty items on it. With this, he has now produced a company and employs several people with full-time jobs. The biggest novelty item in his catalog is called the toilet timer, which is a whimsical little sand timer meant to keep people from hogging time in the restroom. I'll spare you any more details. But suffice it to say, I'm endlessly tickled by the interest and sales associated with this product. There are actual doctors that recommend it to their patients. Department stores stock it on their shelves, and loads of units are flying out of warehouses via e-commerce. He and my sister-in-law even found their way onto the entrepreneur-driven television program Shark Tank. You know the one. It features creators as they seek funding from sharks, who are wealthy financial investors putting up their own money for a piece of the action. I was impressed when they got invited to this program, but I'll admit some worry for them when our whole clan spent an evening of the extended family vacation hearing and giving feedback on their sales pitch. I imagined some of the sharks saying things like, "This isn't a company, this is a product," or, "I don't do novelty stuff," or, "I wish you well, but this isn't for me." I even advised my two intrepid in-laws on which shark to go after. Being somewhat of an expert on this program, I thought I knew whom their best chances were with. They flew to Vegas, participated in a COVID lockdown taping, and were told not to utter a word until it aired on television. And when I finally got to see the program, I took delight in their winsome presentation and was heartily surprised that they made a deal with the least likely and most well-known shark of them all, Mark Cuban. O ye of little faith, why should I have been so concerned? This couple is adorable, smart, winsome, and hilarious, and sales have been coming out of their ears. Jesus, on the other hand, was not a good pitchman, not at least in the gospel story we are reflecting on today. Now, he's just spent quality time eating at a prominent Pharisee's house. The setting must have been small, even intimate. And where we pick up the tale, he is on the road again, still heading toward Jerusalem. The crowds multiply around him, for word has spread. His deeds have gone viral in the community. At the corner shop, a boy tells his father of a miraculous healing Jesus was said to have completed. The watering hole was filled with patriots yearning for someone to mobilize the beleaguered masses in order to begin the counterinsurgence upon Roman despotism. Whispers of hope and the dreams of the good old days filled the air. Jesus' popularity made it easy to follow him, to be one of his faithful disciples, or so it seemed. It is like that when something fresh and new enters into our imagination. It is a version of what I like to call the if-only story. If only this or that, then I would get what I want or be happy or what have you. It took me about 10 years to finish my PhD in theology, what with a move across the country, a growing family, and all the rest of life getting in the way. I remember one dark night of the soul. I was working at 3 a.m. on my writing, uttering quietly to myself, "If only I could complete this degree, then I would feel accomplished." Well, I did finish. I am happy to have done so. But such feelings are moving targets. I once again have other things I want to do, and I'm not sure that I have ever lived in the feeling of accomplishment for very long. If only Jesus would do the thing, lead us into battle with the miracles God gave the likes of Moses, then we would be who we were called to be. In the promise of fulfillment, it is easy to start off strong, making promises with optimism and joy. Just think of your New Year's resolutions. It appears that Jesus has a chance to sell the joys of discipleship to the marching masses. And would not that be the most expedient thing to do? Like one of those pitchmen from late-night infomercials, Jesus could turn with great enthusiasm and sell the promise of something so unbelievable, a la those electronic abdominal machines that do the workout for you. Well, then he could have closed the deal that very day. He looks to them rather serenely and simply says that they cannot be his disciple unless they hate their families. Father, mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, and even life itself. The likes of carnival barkers and pitchmen of all stripes would conclude that Jesus dropped the ball on this one. Hate. Wait. Jesus, I thought you were about love. Haven't we been taught that Christianity is safe for the whole family sort of a religion? I remember serving in a church as an intern. The senior minister and I met with a single young adult male volunteer for lunch one day. Amidst the theological questions asked and answered were also questions about the church's vision. The minister laid out for the young man that the church's target demographic was a young, upwardly mobile married couple with 2.5 kids, a dog, living in a nice home in the expensive neighborhood around the church. Then he added that our ministries would be done in order to reach them. He continued, "We want to teach men how to be better fathers and husbands. We want to support wives so they can stay at home if they like. We want to help children to obey and respect their parents. The church can be tools for this family unit." The young man was crestfallen. I could see the look on his face. So later that evening, I asked him for a coffee. And in that coffee chain, he asked me, "Do I have a place in the church's vision if I'm not the target demographic? I don't have a family." What would Jesus think of a church having a target demographic, or the relegation of our religion into a faith for the family? I'll admit it, it's confusing, this language of hate. How can one hate their mom and dad if in the commandments the people of God were instructed to honor mother and father? How is one supposed to square this teaching with others from Jesus like, "Love your neighbor as yourself"? Let me suggest that the language is confused by certain contexts. When you or I use the word hate, we mean more than lack of affection. It conjures up notions of distaste, despising another, or wishing for their death. But the language behind this word in St. Luke's Gospel has more to do with turning away from or placing less value in these relationships. It is as if Jesus knows that his path requires a single-minded focus upon him. Therefore, one must reorder their life's values. What Jesus seems to be saying, my friends, is that in order to be his disciple, you have to turn away from all you hold dear or put less value there. because to truly follow Jesus is a cost, and you must count the cost. This is not about hate in the conventional sense. It is about reordering our loves. The crowds may think it will be easy or thrilling to follow this miracle worker. It's the thing to do, after all, because everyone is doing it. But Jesus knows what true discipleship looks like: taking up one's own cross and following after the way of Christ. Now, we read this bit after the crucifixion. I presume the crowds had no idea that Jesus would die of cross death. So what would they have made of the cross language here? For starters, it was a shameful way to die for traitors and slaves. It was shameful for its caused humiliation of being mocked and ridiculed. It was shameful because on the cross one is displayed publicly in the nude. It did not merely cause physical pain, but emotional and social pain as well. Again, Jesus is not the pitch man that even many preachers are. Christ tells the truth at all cost. On our side of this story, we know that the cross marks the death of Jesus. In order to be his disciple, you have to value all that you hold dear a little less, or you have to turn away some. This is not the hate we have become accustomed to. On account of the fact that to truly follow his ways, you will take on great suffering, estrangement, and may even be called to lay down your life for the sake of another. This is the sales pitch of the gospel. I don't know, maybe many in the crowd remained undeterred. I am sure that many thought they would gladly suffer for the patriotic stance of sending Rome away. But Jesus was not fighting Rome. Jesus was peaceably ushering in a new way of being, God's kingdom. Flags, territories, victories in battle, and all that do not mark God's kingdom. Rather, it is marked out by the kind of love for all, family included, that requires a handing over of oneself in death for the good of the other. I suppose that in every generation of the church, there is something of a challenge that disciples must count what the cost of following Jesus really is. For the early church, it meant persecution and death, and at times it meant living into the identity of a group of strange ragamuffins that no one understands. Through the centuries, the church gained power, and to be faithful, it had to negotiate its way through being co-opted by the interest of nation-states and the powerful elite. In the civil rights era of our own country, many disciples counted the cost by staking their claim for equality, even if it meant what the inimitable John Lewis called getting into good trouble. Today's generation of disciples have been witnessing the rise of secularity, church decline, and DIY spirituality, much to the chagrin of pastors and parishioners alike. NYU business professor Scott Galloway, in his book Post-Corona, which he published in the middle of the pandemic, argues that every trend we saw prior to COVID has been exponentially boosted as a result of it: e-commerce, telehealth, higher education changes, etc. I think the same can be said for secularity and church decline. Now, there will always be a church, but many will close. Some churches will thrive. But in our day, we face changes about the future of the church and what we can come to expect about a culture that some think is a Christian one. We could respond to these challenges by taking up ideological arms and enter into a so-called culture war, deluding ourselves into thinking that we'll win the world for Jesus. We could imagine that legislating our faith values will fix the woes of the world. It won't. The narrative can still be spun that if schools allowed prayer, then there would be a lot less school shootings. Doubtful. We could happily march with crowds sharing stories about the good old days and how if we just return to them, that'll get the young folk back into the pews. Yeah, millennials and Gen Z respond the same way to the methods of ministry that Gen X, boomers, and all before them have. Right? If only then, if only then, if... only. But I hear Jesus say, count the cost of following me in this time and season. Beloved, stop trying to win. Just follow me and do the next faithful thing. Reassess what is most important to you. Take up your cross and follow me. You may not look like the winner, but you may. You may transform the world through self-giving love. In reassessing what is most important to us, we may find that we have to walk away from our heritage that we hold so dear, the heritage that gives us privilege, in order to share equality with others. Take up your cross, good Christian. In revaluing the most important values of our lives, we may find that we need to lessen our political and party passions. In revaluing the most important values of our lives, we may find that we need to lessen our political and party passions. Research indicates in our ever-polarized world that people want to go to church that is filled with like-minded voters. But what good does that do for the body of Christ and for the world for which it ministers to? Take up your cross, good Christian. In counting the cost, you may need to be like an old friend of mine. Years ago, I asked him to help lead the youth ministry of our church. At this point in his life, he was a church wallflower at best, and only marginally living up to the beliefs he had assented to in his baptism. When I asked for his help, he stared at me like a deer looking in headlights. It rocked him in his spirit. He took time to think and pray before he committed. A week later, he told me he felt like he needed to become ready. He had to put some old things behind him, and it was his time to get single-mindedly focused about following the way of Christ. He, good Christian, counted the cost and took up his cross. Do the same. Amen.
You've been listening to the Reverend Dr. Jared Longbons, Senior Minister of Peachtree Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in Atlanta, Georgia. For a free transcript of his sermon today titled, Jesus, Not a Good Pitch Man, call us at 404-815-9110. That's 404-815-9110. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. I'm Peter Wallace. Next week on Day One, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Dr. Teresa Fry Brown, the Bandy Professor of Preaching at Candler School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Her powerful sermon is called A Divine Cure for Heart Conditions. Be sure to join us next time on Day One. Week after week, Day One proclaims God's hope for our hurting and divided world. But we can't do it without your help. Please mail your gift to Day One, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Or call us at 404-815-9110. Or give securely online at dayone.org. And thank you. Now, our Day One preacher, Jared Longbons, offers some final thoughts on his message today, Jesus, Not a Good Pitchman. And Jared, you told us about your creative brother-in-law and his invention, the toilet timer. You said he and his wife were adorable, smart, winsome, and very successful, great pitchmen for their product. But on the other hand, Jesus is not a good pitchman, you said, at least not in this story from Luke chapter 14. It seems like for centuries, Christians have tried to package as palatable a message as possible about what is required to join up. And if we compare some of that with what Jesus says, it sure looks like we've made following Jesus too easy, too simple, and maybe too inconsequential. So how might we reset our expectations of what Jesus really wants from his followers?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question. I've devoted a seminary education and a PhD on thinking along those lines, and a lot of that time was devoted reading the philosopher, the 19th century philosopher from Denmark, Soren Kierkegaard, mm-hmm. who says that when you're confronted with the notion that there's a man dying on a cross and that's God, you have one of two ways of responding. Mm. You can accept that in faith or walk away offended. Mm-hmm. And I really think the way the world is right now, it's pushing us to that easy question. Are we going to follow that in faith, or are we going to be offended? The way of cultural Christianity seems to be waning. The authority and power of the church being aligned with mainline world is diminishing. And so there's a great culling. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're going to see is people who either go, yeah, I'm going to follow by taking up my cross, even if it means I don't get everything I want in this world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to secure things for me, and I might even suffer for it, or walk away offended.
You said this language Jesus uses of hating our family is confusing. How can one hate parents if in the Ten Commandments God's people are instructed to honor them? And you helped us understand that while we can get tripped up on that word, it's really more about turning away from or placing less value on other people and things, and instead prioritizing our walk with Jesus. You told us you hear Jesus say, "Beloved, stop trying to win. Just follow me and do the next faithful thing." I love that. So what might authentic discipleship look like in our everyday lives?
Well, I think in the way that you handle your own families, for instance, if you are blessed to have family or loved ones or friends, and most people have someone they care about, mm-hmm. how can you live in such a way as to elevate those relationships before God? How can you live in such a way as to make other people flourish before God? How can you serve them? How can you show Christ-likeness to them? And there are times when people are going to ask you to walk away from your faith or dilute it perhaps for some other ends, but can you draw your boundary and say, no, I'm absolutely going to use these resources for those in need because that's what Christ asked me for. Whereas you could say, I'm going to use these resources to be more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think it's just about folk putting the priorities in an order that makes most sense. And when it comes to our loved ones, I don't believe Jesus really means to hate the way we mean it. I think it is literally, how can we prioritize the way of the cross first? And then how do we love people under that the correct way? So it's about reordering our loves.
Mm-hmm. Jared, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind in the days ahead?
I think that it is that each stage of the history of our church, we've had to deal with something different and ask the question, what does it mean to follow Christ in this season? And I think there is pressing questions in our polarized world. I think we might have to ask ourselves, do we love our heritage or our skin color or our background more than we should? Or do we love our political platforms more than we should?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to put those on a lesser footing for the sake of other people's betterment and their flourishing? And I think that seems like the pathway of the cross.
Jared Longbons, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.